Thanks, Phil. It's great to be here. For those of you who look at the slide and probably think, oh, I think I'm in the wrong room because this doesn't look like evangelistic courses, I'm going to explain that in a minute. Let me introduce myself. It'll save Phil the pain of trying to do that. And then I'll show you something about why we're here. My wife has got out of the queue for the book buying. And so Jane, my wife, is at the back. And as I tell people, she's the brains of the outfit. She's the creative director of Olive Tree Media and the producer of the actual role of producer of the products that we produce. So my background actually is as a church leader and a Baptist church leader. I ran a large Baptist church. It's always interesting to use that term. And then because Phil actually said to me, he's dealing with revitalizing larger churches. I said, well, what is large? In the Australian context, if you're getting more than 400 on a Sunday, that's large, which is a little significantly larger than what Phil was talking about. So we ran a church in Sydney of, you know, over 500 on a Sunday, a multi-staff church. I did that for 20 years. On top of that, I ran a thing called the Arrow Leadership Development Program, which is here in England, but it's under CPAX in England. So, and then a number of other kind of broader national roles. As well as that, dabbled in media for a long time. And was hosted a bunch of TV shows. And then we created a television show a couple of years ago called Towards Belief, around the same time that we created an organisation called Olive Tree Media to house the material that we were doing. After doing Towards Belief, we then started working towards this series I'm going to show you a clip of, and called Jesus the Game Changer. That coincided with the time of shifting out of church leadership. So I'm now doing Olive Tree Media and media ministry full time. Much of that change was to do with we were doing a lot of things internationally, and just running a local church and doing things internationally is a big stretch. Flying interstate is easy. Internationally is a lot harder. So it was just under God the right time for us to make that change. So part of the reason I'm here, and this will be part of what we're doing in this session, is to introduce, let people know about Jesus the Game Changer. If you're thinking, oh, that's good because you know he's doing a bit of an ad for something he wants us to go upstairs and buy, you can't. They're all sold. So they're still available through Authentic Media and through Eden here in the UK. But as a way of looking at what we do, what we produce, this is a 10-part DVD series. While it's on global Christian networks, it's the heart behind it is for local church ministry. I'll say something quickly about that and then get on with the seminar. So here's the trailer. In many countries and communities today, religion is believed to be irrelevant, even dangerous, and something to be feared. What people fail to grasp is that the values Western democracies are built on come from the teaching of Jesus. Values such as the equality of all people, education for everyone, humility and service in leadership.
I would say the world is completely different because of Jesus, his death and his resurrection.
He's showing us what it means to be human.
And there's people who are intrigued by this. They get woke up, they're dissatisfied, they're hungry, they're thirsty, they're restless. And they say, I think I will give him a try. I think I will try to do what he says.
I wouldn't even know where to start. It changed everything for me. And I hope it's still changing everything for me every day because I'm not exactly finished.
He brought the practice of and the message of the unconditional love of God.
It is easy for us to love those who love us, but the true challenge is loving those who are not kind to us.
This piece of dust, I'll live forever, because I'm linked up with God through what Jesus has done. Now, for me, can I tell you, that's a total game changer because it gives me eternity.
Western civilization would not exist had not there been Jesus.
because he took this unnamed, unwanted, abused, adopted chick that should have been a statistic, and he was the game changer. He just turned my life around radically.
This series is a journey through the United States, the UK, India, Singapore, and Australia, talking with more than 30 academics, authors, researchers, and modern-day game changers about how the life and teaching of Jesus changed the world and why it matters.
They were a relatively small group of people who sought to follow this Jesus of Nazareth. Why did the life and teaching of Jesus become such a game changer?
So my friend here, John, just asked, is this the same as yesterday's seminar? It's not, if you're here from yesterday. It's very different, but I did want to introduce, for those who weren't here yesterday, this series. Just to let you know, it is a DVD. My son, who's an IT guy, when we were making this, we said, where are we up? Where are you up to, Dad? And I said, we're pressing the DVDs. He said, seriously, Dad, does anybody still buy a DVD? Well, they do, actually. But it can be streamed as well, so if that helps you. It has a discussion guide, if you watch it on television, it looks like just another television show, but it works as something to use with a small group, either with believers to give them encouragement or those who are seeking and are looking to explore Jesus. It's a bit like doing cultural apologetics rather than intellectual apologetics. That discussion guide is a free app. You can go to Google Play, iTunes, download it as a free app. It's got a link to Bible verses. You can make notes in it. You can't watch the episodes on it, but that's a free app. And then using my wife's, Jane's, photos, this is the biggest evangelistic tract you'll ever see. Won't fit in your pocket, but essentially that is what this is. It's a coffee table book of the series. All her photos, beautiful photos, beautifully produced. It looks great. And you can just read, grab quotes, or you can actually take the content of the series through the book. We've actually just released a kids' book. We've got a school curriculum. There's all sorts of ways that we're trying to use this for gospel ministry as broadly as we can. But that's not what we're doing in this session. I know this session was called about evangelistic courses, but one of the things I wanted to do was talk about the opportunity for evangelism. And I think this comes out of John's session, and John's here, so it better come out of his session. He'll let me know later if it didn't. In what he was saying about the challenge of the gospel in modern Western nations. And John's point about the 3% within the UK who are Bible-believing, saved in our sense, our theological perspective. And you can, basically, it's right to make that point, and it's right to recognise that the task is enormous. But that can sometimes mislead us, and certainly the commentariat can mislead us as to what people think about Christianity in the church. If we did a little kind of survey right now, we won't, but if we did, there's a good chance that most of you think, I know what the community think of Christianity. You know, Australia is seen as probably more secular than the UK, maybe not as mixed racially, but certainly it's a pretty, very secular nation. And there's this sense that the church is disliked, the church is hated, the church is written off, the church doesn't have a place anymore, and we're coming from this incredibly low ebb seeking to bring the gospel message of Jesus. So what is the perception of places like Australia and England, the US? I'm going to give you some figures out of one slide out of the US, a couple of slides out of the UK, then slides out of this research in Australia. So why do we do this research? I mentioned to you before we did a series called Towards Belief. And Towards Belief is about diffusing the belief blockers of our time. It's apologetics, a bit like what Don Carson is talking about in Defeater Beliefs, same sort of thing. It's diffusing the belief blockers of our time, but doing it as a documentary style. And when we were first planning this, probably 8 years ago now, we had a really bright group of people in central Sydney got together, and we basically said, look, we're thinking about doing this. What should we do? And we kind of brainstormed about what we should do. One of the guys in the group said, you know, Carl, the problem is when it comes to belief blockers and what people think of Christianity and what's blocking Christianity in their life, there's a lot of commentary, but there's not much data. So we need to go and find some data. So that actually started, it's a funny thing that only four data for a series. We went out and did this research. What then happened, that was called the Australian Communities Report, that got released. And the interesting thing is that almost had as much life in the church community as the series did, because there were lots of groups that started to use that data. Then about 5 years later, they came back to me, these ministry groups within the Australian community, and said, this is now 5 years old. We're using it all the time. We should redo it. So essentially we did, and this time it was called Faith and Belief. If this is your thing, you're a bit of a nerd around this area, if this is your thing, you can actually go to faithandbelief.org.au and you can download everything for free. So it's open source. There's a video, there's a PowerPoint with more slides you'll ever know what to do with. There's a 54-page PDF, and I'm just giving you a small slice of some of that information. So why are we doing this? So what do Western nations think of Christianity in the church? You know, what's the ground rules? Where do we sit? What have we got to work with? When we talk about evangelism and evangelistic courses and connecting with the community, where do we start from a community's perception of the church? And that's what we were trying to do. So this is, now Australia, I didn't put the slide up, but Australia does a census every 5 years. I don't know if you heard this, you probably didn't get any press about this in Australia. This year, for the first time, last year when they did it for the first time, or 2016, which is a couple of years now, they decided to do an online one. So, it was great. This one night, you get to go online and you didn't have to fill out a paper form. You could just go online. Within half an hour, it crashed. It crashed, irredeemably crashed. It was lost for eternity. And it was just, yeah. Anyway, when they found out why it crashed, it was just embarrassing for the people to put it together. But we did do a census, and the census showed a big shift in Australia. We went from 62% saying that they were Christian in some form back to 51%. And the growth in the non-religion, we're going to come to that in a moment, jumped from 23% to 30% in the census. Now, the interesting thing is that the Atheist Society, they call themselves something different than that, in Australia ran a campaign saying, put no religion, vote nons. The Census Department, it's interesting the political machinations going on. They actually moved non from last box to first box. You think about that. So don't think this is all neutral. And they were working as hard as they could to get nons as high as they possibly could. Now, here's the deal. In the census, which is a very blunt instrument, the way that question is asked, half Australians still ticked a box that said, we're Christian. Now, you're all thinking, and John was saying, they're not Christians. Like, that's what we're thinking. But here's the deal. They think they are. Now, that's a gospel challenge, but it is also a gospel opportunity. So when McCrindle did this, this is a kind of a more focused way of asking that question. And so McCrindle's research is very focused. Over 1,000 people did the survey, which if you're into statistics and data, you've got to get over 1,000 people for it to be seen as statistically viable. It's also, the stats also reflect the demographic breakdown of Australia. So education, ethnicity, country versus city, age bracket. So it's a pretty fair representation. The only thing that's a negative is it's an online one, so that kind of has a slight slant in it. But all that's to say, this can be trusted as reasonable. And what you could do is you couldn't, like within the census, like about 8% of Australians just go, I'm not going to answer the question. Well, in this, you're not allowed to pass it up. Also, Jedi Knights was not an option. Did you hear about that? Like in New Zealand and Australia, there's apparently thousands of their religion is Jedi Knights. Let's not take that too seriously. So, and then the other thing that McCrindle did was this little kind of section here. So he added this box, which was spiritual but not religious. And that picked up 14% of people. So when you asked, are you Christian? Do you see yourself as a Christian? Do you identify with Christianity? Now, you'll see a statistic I'm going to give you later, which seems to be slightly at odds with this. 45% of Australians still say that they are. Now, of that, 15% see them as a churchgoer. 7% see themselves as extremely involved. Well, that's kind of us, all right? Guymia Baptist, we used to do a survey once a year, and there was all these questions. We'd ask the same question just to see how we were tracking. And one of the questions was, do you go to church every week? Okay, you know that question? Do you go to church every week? And there's, you know what? 73% ticked a box that was, yes, I go to church every week. I want you to know that was an aspirational tick. They do not go to church every week. I know that. The only people who go to church every week is the people that are sitting in this room. They're paid to be there. You know, it's one of the massive changes in churches these days, in the sense that what used to be almost, as a Baptist, twice a Sunday, you know, you went in the morning and then at night there was the gospel service and a different group of people responded each week. But it was essentially that was Sundays. Now it's probably between 2 and 3 times a month. That's the kind of going every week. But you see, now this, again, this is not a theological test. This is not saying, okay, you've got to tick all these boxes. Yes, you can say you're a Christian if you agree with all these ideas. These are people just saying, here's where I think I sit. Now, you'll notice that you've got no religion is 32%, which is pretty much where the census was. So once you had spiritual and not religious, this number stays about the same. In a lot of countries, and I'm not sure what your stats are here on this, in a lot of countries, especially if you go to Australia, you hang around Sydney or Melbourne, you get the sense that you're being swamped by people who are from the Islamic faith. But it's a perception, not a reality. I mean, there's still only, in Australia, 2.5%. If you put all the other religions together, it's only 9%, all of them combined. What you see in this no religion, there's two things to take note of. So when it says spiritual but not religious, there's this idea that there's an ultimate meaning to life, an inward journey, a mixture of religious beliefs. The concept there is I am not committed to an organized religious group with a kind of defined framework, but there's something more there. This group is interesting, not religious. Check out the largest number. You can't read this. Let me read 49% to you. Prefer science and evidence-based approach. Now, you think about that. You've got 49% of 32%, 15% of the population, who think that they're scientism. They're into scientism. And you and I both know, well, we ought to know, that that's not a reality. It's not religion versus science. That's a very modern idea. If you're working in a church and you are seeking to do kind of defense of the faith and you don't have an answer to that question, you probably should go and find one. And you should preach on it on a semi-regular basis. Not just because you're probably thinking, well, I wouldn't preach on that. There's nobody in my church that thinks that. All their friends do, and they need an answer. And when you preach on it and talk about it and communicate on it, you give them a framework to respond to their friends. So that's kind of where the Australian environment fits. Interestingly, this whole research was repeated in New Zealand last year. New Zealand's a little country just off our east coast, sort of seen as a bit of a state of Australia, except that it basically kicks our butt in every sport we play against them, so we don't mention them.
We know the feeling.
Yeah, I'm in good company here. The interesting thing about New Zealand, it will be, I read this week, it will be one of three nations around the world that probably in the next year, the nones will overtake people who say they're Christian or of faith. Their last census was like Christian was about 46%, nones were about 44%. Like, so that's massive when you think about it. So we're looking seriously religious in Australia compared to New Zealand. But all I'm saying is a lot of the outcomes in New Zealand, even though that was the case, was actually fairly similar to these. So if you're thinking, oh, this wouldn't be like the UK, there's a good chance it's a bit closer than you think. Here's the big change, and it started in the 60s, the 70s, where the growth of nones, the no religion, the people who were willing to say, and I think that phrase, I want you to hear that phrase, were willing to say they weren't Christian. That's not to say that, you know, here 96% of Australians were Christians. That's simply not the case. But that was the box that you ticked. Billy Graham came to Australia in 1959. Closest thing that our country has ever seen to a religious revival. Absolutely remarkable. If you watch cricket and you've seen the MCG, this massive arena, do you know that the record for the most people in the MCG is still held by Billy Graham in March 1959? 140,000 people. Now you think about that, 140,000 people just sit, which are now, you had him in 56, is it, in Harringate, is that right? You know, like a similar kind of outcome. But part of the reason that was the case is this number. You know, it was taking people who are nominally of faith and telling them what faith actually was. Now we're dealing with something completely different. It's not to say that crusades and large events don't work. Everything has its place. But the point is, it's a very different situation. You know, the first census ever done in Australia was in the 19th century, and it was 100% Christians. How about that, eh? 100%. They all went there as convicts. There was a bit of a discipleship issue, but there wasn't a faith issue, you know. So going from that, now, this is jumping to... The reason this is different is, it's because I'm incompetent as a slide builder, but this is actually from NCLS, so National Church Life Survey. So the National Church Life Survey, they do that in Australia once every 5 years, and it's looking at churches, but they also did a similar piece of research to faith and belief. Now, I'm just putting this up for two reasons, to show you this. They say in theirs that it's just... I mean, this is like 2 months old. So they're saying churchgoer at 16%, frequent attender, they say at 20%. Now, again, this is people saying what they do. So take this with a massive grain of salt. This is not saying that they're Christian, okay? It's not a theological point, but here's the deal. 20% of Australians, a secular nation, are willing to say, I go to church. Now, check this chart. Now, again, we're being told constantly that church attendance is falling, it's crashing to the ground, nobody's going to church anymore, et cetera, et cetera. I know that's a challenge, but keep these sorts of stats in mind. Between 1950, this is 1950, to where we are today, and theirs is an outlier on their projection. So if this is the line is their projection, this figure is above their projection. So it's maybe a slight outlier or there's change. Now, the interesting thing that you see is between 1950... through about 85, it dropped something like 23%. From 85 to the year 2000, it dropped 5%. From the year 2000 to now, it's flat. And the great news is we've stopped declining. Now you kind of think, well, you're really scraping the barrel if that's the good news. But it actually speaks into the narrative that says we're continuing to crash and it's still going downhill. Rodney Stark released a book in 2016 called Triumph, I think, something like Triumph of Faith. And he uses stats out of America, and Ed Stetzer quoted these stats just last year when I heard him speak, that American weekly attendance for the last 30 years hasn't changed. It's sat at about 30%. So there is a change, but it's not this number. And it's what McCrindle, I was actually with Mark McCrindle last week in Sydney, and the point he's making now is that between the year 2000 to where we are now, the kind of attendance is actually flat. But what's happening is, if you can imagine another grid on the top of this, which is people who are willing to call themselves or refer to themselves or align themselves with Christianity, is dropping. So that... it's a bit like this number's flat, but this number's dropping. So the group of people that are low-hanging fruit or hardened because they think they're already there, you choose, that's the piece that's changing. So it's just an interesting kind of where we are. Here, I'll explain it. This is out of America. Ed Stetzer put this out a couple of years ago. Again, really, really interesting. So this line here, mainline Protestant. Now, as somebody else has written, we need to change that name because they're not actually mainline anymore. But the group that would call themselves mainline Protestant, probably Episcopal, United Methodist, that sort of group, prodigious decline. This is 1970. This is about 15, 16, okay? Here, they are dropping. Where are they going to? No faith. Has gone from 5% all the way to 22%. What's interesting is evangelical Protestant started at 18, high point of 30, at 23 and maybe kicking up again. So what you see happening is, and I'm going to come back to this, a loss of nominalism. That's what you see happening. So for people who probably didn't go to church that much anyway, but said, yes, I'm in a mainline Protestant church, that number's dropping. The people willing to say, you know what, I don't have any faith, I'm proud of it, that is growing. But those who have kind of always been Bible-believing are sort of sitting in a reasonably flat zone. The influence shaping our opinions, family and parents and family still have enormous influence. And that's kind of encouraging. If you're here and you've got a 14-year-old and you think it's about 10 years since they heard a word you said, they are listening. Because 57% of people are still saying that their parents and family are having an influence. Apparently, people still read books. So that just gives you a look at the influence people they're having. Media, Gen Z up to 75, you know, 24% compared to 14% overall in social media. So I'm just grabbing a couple of things that might be of interest to you. People are still willing to talk about their faith a bit, or faith in general, have discussions in general. 55% talk about it at some point. So there's still some discussions. What this piece of research said, which I'll have one slide later, is that if you are in kind of the youngest generations, under 30, you are more likely to talk about religious issues on a regular basis and do it kind of more openly. So the interesting thing is that the younger generations aren't talking less, they're having more conversations, not less conversations. What they talk about is different again. Now, here's this Australian's attitude towards Christianity. Now, this is loosely built on the Engel scale, and although I've heard of Engel scales that goes to 12, this is to minus 7. Dr. Engels created a scale which said, okay, if you're not a Christian, how far are you from the kingdom, as it were? So you think about this in your own life. You know, people you know that aren't Bible-believing Christians, they're not all angry atheists. Some of them are actually quite close to where you sit. The question is, so within the Australian environment, where do people sit? So that's what McCrindle was trying to work out. So this is where it's a bit tricky. I consider myself a Christian, 38%. So they tick the box. Now, two things. If people are inconsistent in their answers, you can't really send the survey back and say, you got it wrong, get it right. You know, like, so you've got to put up with inconsistency and margins of error. The difference here is, the first question was, yeah, I identify with Christianity in some way. When asked, am I a Christian, 38% said yes, they were. Now, there's a big difference between 38% and 3% John talked about. This is not a theological test. That's what's really key. This is the self-perception of where they sit, and all of us would agree that most of them have got that perception wrong. What this is doing, though, is more than... The bigger question is, if you said, OK, I am not a Christian, where do you sit? Now, this is what you find. 24% sat in warm. In other words, I believe in Christianity but don't consider myself a Christian. That's pretty close, isn't it? I believe much of Christianity but still have some significant doubts. So here you have this idea that if you put these two together, 62% of people within the Australian environment think they're a Christian. If they're not, they're warm towards it. There were those 12% who were neutral. There were those that were angry. The interesting thing is, if you listen to the commentariat, you think that everybody sits here. They don't, actually. And I'll come back to that. Do you know somebody who's a Christian? And this is pointing towards the difference between the concrete and the abstract. So this said, do you know someone who's a Christian? So in Australia, 46% of people knew 11 to 20 or more people who are Christians in their life, which is a big number. 1.5 million Australians, or 8%, don't know any Christians. This is Western Australia over here, Western Australia. This is nation's Western Australia. This is Sydney's here, Brisbane, Melbourne. So I've done this presentation in Western Australia, and they look at that and go, yeah, well, that's obvious, Carl. They're all over East, aren't they? So here's the deal. That's just a graphic representation. So of the people who know Christians, they were then asked, what are the Christians you know like? Now, that wasn't an open-ended question. They were given 20 options. And the 20 options went from really positive things to really negative things. And you chose the ones that you thought represented the Christians that you know. Now, again, if you think about the commentary that you're constantly hearing, in your mind you'd be thinking about, well, so what do you think they might have said? Now, don't answer that question, but just think about what you think they said. So, top 10 perceptions of Christians, and here are the top five. Caring, loving, kind, honest, and faithful. Now, let's let that sink in. Now, even number 6 is not that bad, which is traditional. Opinionated and critical, hypocritical are there. Now, we're going to see that there's a kind of issue around this. So, Have you heard of a thing called Talking Jesus? Now, EA in England did a study called Talking Jesus. Again, go to Talking Jesus, just Google Talking Jesus. I think it's talkingjesus.co or something, or .uk. Go to the website, all the information's there. Very cool animated little summary statement at the beginning of Talking Jesus. They did the same thing. They asked the question here in the UK, what are the top perceptions of the Christians that you know? Here it is. Friendly, caring, good-humoured, generous, encouraging, hopeful. The difference between orange and blue were the orange were about under 22, some age bracket. So this was the younger age bracket. This was the older age bracket. One of the things that we noticed as a matter of interest, again, in our research, and you'll see on this page and in other research, the idea that the next generations are all different and all the generations are different is actually a bit of a myth. There's not that much different with younger generations. In our material, you know what younger generations hold to? They talk about Christianity more, religion, not Christianity, religion more often. So the idea that they're completely different, I think, is a little bit over-egged. I'm not saying there aren't differences. Of course there are. But it's a bit over-egged. Now, you might be thinking, so what are the low numbers? What about the negative? Here's look at the negative. Hurtful, 2, 3. Unhappy, 4%. Homophobic, 7%. Uptight, 8%. Hypocritical, 10%. So, so the idea is, if you say to people, what's the church? Do you know, what's the church like? Oh, it's terrible. You know, what's the local church like? Awful. What are Christians like? Oh, they're a homophobic, hypocritical group. Do you know any Christians? Oh, yeah. Fred and Mary. What are they like? They're great people. it's a really interesting thing that in the abstract, it's all negative. In the concrete, it's quite different. The commentariat work off the abstract. The people in your community are more likely to work off the concrete. So that doesn't mean there aren't issues. So when we ask the question about belief blockers, what blocks you from faith, these are the top blockers. So homosexuality. Now, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because if you see this number here, homophobic is only 7%, but when you see what's a blocker to faith, 66%, the highest number. Now, these were blockers around issues. So hell and damnation, suffering, supernatural role of women, Bible, science and evolution. If you go to behaviour, church abuse, religious wars, hypocrisy, judging others, and issues around money. Interestingly, I think that church abuse and hypocrisy are very strongly linked. And in the Australian environment, the reason this is so high is we've just had about a five-year Royal Commission into the institutional abuse of children, and the church has been front and centre. Huge issue. The church across the board has instituted changes and controls, etc., which I think if we did this in 20 years' time, if I'm still alive, if they did this in 20 years' time, I reckon that number will halve, because that will not be the issue it is today. It's a bit, I know about England, but I know Ireland has been a huge issue in Ireland. You could equate what's happened in Ireland to what's happened in Australia. It's very patchy. The other thing is, as an aside, the Catholic Church is dealing with 6 times the number of cases of all other denominations combined. So if you combine all the other denominations together, the Catholics are dealing with 6 times the number of cases. And that's for a couple of reasons, but one, there seems to have been, it's just in ground, there were groups working together, which is just an appalling thought, isn't it? But the other thing too is the Catholics have had a lot more opportunity and because they had schools and all of that. But that's not to say that everybody loves us and everything's fine. There are certainly issues to deal with.
Can you get back to the belief side?
Sorry?
Do you
catch
the belief side again? The blockers?
Yes, that one?
Yeah.
So they are the key blockers. Now, again, I think people misread this in they say, okay, we've got to change our views on homosexuality. that's just happening all over the place. Nobody says we change our views. It just says these are the issues we've got to deal with. These are the things we've got to have an answer to and respond to. As I said, if this is your thing, just go to faithandbelief.org.au and you can get the whole thing. So here's this. What do you value about your local church? This was released after I finished running a local church. And for those of you who are running a local church and for the years I ran a local church, this is actually a slightly depressing slide. What do people want in their local church? Look at the first top two. A supportive community and social connections. They want to belong. Look at the stuff that I, as a church leader, focused on all the time I was leading a church. Leadership and vision, learning about faith, in other words, preaching. You know, like we're down there number four and five. and so it's a really interesting thing that I think this is incredibly important. Belonging, loved, cared for, not just necessarily agreed with. That becomes really important. That's what people are looking for in their local church. What do you know about your local church? I'm going to come back to this slide later. I'm going to bring this up again. But 56% really know nothing about their local church. But the interesting thing is, even though they know nothing about their local church, they're fairly sure it's positive. Which is kind of bizarre, isn't it? You know, I don't know anything about the church. Is it doing a good job? It's great. which is odd for a bunch of Australians. Non-Christians' openness, you know, 10% are very interested, 13% would consider. So you've got 23% of people who are saying that they're open in some way to look at or discuss or think about their Christian faith and belief. So what this is getting kind of more toward the subject matter that this seminar was about. So what does all this mean? What does it mean for gospel ministry? What does it mean for you as a local church leader and a pastor running a local church? What does it mean on a day-to-day basis? Because, you know, you can talk about stats and research till, you know, you're bored stupid, which you might already be there. But that doesn't change anything. So here's my reflections on that. The first is variety and polarization. That's what we're dealing with in countries like Australia, New Zealand, America, the UK. There's this sense of, you know, like if you look at that and you go, wow, everybody quite likes us. But if you read the paper, that's not the impression that you get. If you watch news outlets, please, Jesus, don't read Twitter. You know, it's so you've got variety and polarization. And the point I would say is that polarization is often the commentariat have a vested interest inside and outside the church to make it sound as bad as they possibly can. Outside the church is because they want to shut the church down. Our media in Australia has a couple of outlets that are significantly have a stance that really is negatively exposed to the church. And they will make it sound as bad as they possibly can. They will run negative stories. They will slant everything they can. They have an overwhelming majority of people who are not only nons, but they're angry nons. They're on the kind of, you know, sitting in the Engels scale. They're the -7, -8s in the scale. And that's where they sit. And that's reflected in what you watch and read. But that doesn't mean that that's where everybody is. The average person is not necessarily in that place, which is an encouraging thing to say, is there's plenty more opportunity than you think. Second thing to say, the death of nominalism. What we said before is at one point, if you go back, certainly before the 60s, which is a long time ago now, there was a very high percentage of people who would tick a Christian box but never go to church other than a couple of times a year. And they would sort of say, like Jane and I were staying at Dartmouth and we were chatting to the guy who was running the motel we were staying at. We gave him a copy of our small tract, Jane signed it, and we were chatting and he said to me, oh, you should go to my local church. And Jane and I walked away and thought, you know, I bet he's never been. Because when we saw his local church, it was the local Anglican church, you know, and I'm sure, but that was his church, you know, and I think that's his sense of, that's my church, that's my religion, I don't actually go. But that means that the death of nominalism means that there's still people that are kind of, how do I put this, leaning in, as it were, in a wider opportunity in the community. The importance of families and safe, trusted spaces. And I think for the local church, right across all of our nations, the opportunity for families and family life and safe, trusted places for families is a great opportunity. I want to show you this in a couple of stats out of Australia. The first one on radio. Some of you have listened to Christian radio once and sworn you'll never go back. But the thing I say in Australia, I'm going to give you two areas of statistics in Australia. The two biggest areas of growth in Australia for influence in the community are Christian radio and Christian schools. Trouble is most Christians don't kind of see that. They write it off as just, you know, bad music and bad radio. But here's the deal with radio. Here is the growth of Christian radio stations in Australia in the last 30 years or so, from 2 to 41. 41 stations. Now, that 41 stations doesn't include a thing called Vision Media. And Vision Media, they beam out from a satellite. This is going to, if you know anything about radio, I'm about to embarrass myself. They basically beam it out from a satellite across Australia. Then local, like little local towns, like tiny little local towns, pull it down on a stick and then throw it out 5 kilometres. You don't need a license, and therefore it's a local radio station. So there are 700 of those across Australia. Now, McNair Polling, who actually does data about who's listening to what radio stations, 3.68 million Australians are listening to Christian radio on a monthly basis. Our population is 25 million. Like, that number is massive. And are they listening to Christian radio because they want the Christian message? No. They're listening to Christian radio because they've been driving along for years when they were young and hip and you know, just them and their partner in the car and enjoying ribald humour and all that sort of stuff that most FM stations run on these days. And then they have a kid. And then they're driving their kid to school. And they suddenly think, I don't want my kids to listen to this. This is rubbish. And so what are they looking for? A safe station. But the point is this. While they're looking for a safe station, they don't leave the station because it has a Christian message. Now, these stations in Australia are probably a bit more like Premier Radio. They're mixed music stations. They play secular songs, secular music, although they choose what they play very carefully. They have one-minute radio spots, Christian spots on a very regular basis. So I've done heaps of those, and they've played all over Australia. But nobody turns off because they hear a Christian message. Nobody turns off because they hear a Christian song. Nobody turns off because they're community-funded stations and they have to help fund them a couple of times a year with big fundraisers. They keep listening. And Melbourne, Light FM in Melbourne, Melbourne's probably got about 3.5 million people. Light FM in Melbourne has a listener base that's not far off 1 million people. I mean, it's just massive opportunity into the community. All we're saying is they don't turn off because it's Christian. Let's go to schools. The biggest growth in attendance in any form of school in Australia over the last 30 years or so had been attendance in non-Catholic or Anglican schools. Now, that, so you've got state schools, then of those who don't go to state schools, a high percentage go to your kind of Catholic school or your Anglican school, kind of classic private schools that have been around for years and years, which you call public schools, don't you? They're the sort of sandstone schools. Over the last 30 years, there's been a massive growth in low-fee paying, what they would refer to as fundamentalist schools. We would just say they're actually Christian schools, where they're based on, run by a church, have some government funding, but they have built on a Christian ethic. The biggest growth in any area of schooling has been that, and it's now up to 34% of those who are in non-government schools. Do they send their kids to the school because they want them to have a Christian education? No. In fact, there's 4 or 5 areas that they say they like the values of the school, they like the way the school's run, they like the discipline, they like the education. But the deal is this. Just because it's a Christian school, they don't all say, oh, no, we're not going to send our kids there if it's Christian. So there's plenty of opportunities around this safe, trusted spaces. Now, you don't have to run a school or a radio station to produce safe, trusted spaces. There are plenty of chances for local churches to influence families. The rise of a neutral, even open generation. Here's this one with one question where conversations in Gen X, you know, thinking about spirituality and religious, what are the top prompts? Well, funny enough, I'm not sure what's happening with the baby boomers. Everybody else has conversations with people, but they don't have them. They're worried about global and national issues. Probably worried about Donald Trump, actually. But the intriguing thing is that this group of people, you know, social media and conversations with people are generating conversations about faith and religion. Here's a quote. I talk about religion daily at work. We're a very tight team, and sometimes we could be joking and someone might make a reference to their religion. We laugh about it. We talk about it. We make sure we check we don't offend. It's a Gen Y person. This came up time and time again. In other words, they're having the conversations. There is the opportunity. Now, they have a particular set of kind of parameters on what they believe or what they think, and there's certainly challenges around it, but there's opportunity. So if those, if I can put this back up, if those are the implications, variety and polarisation, death of nominalism, importance of family and safe places, rise of a neutral, even open generation, what are the outcomes? So what are the implications for gospel ministry? What does all of that say for you and your church? Point one, don't retreat in fear. Because that's what you feel like doing, don't you? Like, don't put your head above the parapet. Don't let anybody know you're out there. We're just going to get bombarded. You're going to get beaten up. Just have you read Rod Dreher's book, The Benedict Option? Now, Rod Dreher, look on your faces, no, I'd say is the fairly general consensus of the room. Rod Dreher's American. He wrote the book probably 2 years ago. It was printed 2 years ago. And it really came out of the Obergefell marriage equality Supreme Court outcome. By the way, did you hear that? I heard social media talk yesterday that it seems like another Supreme Court judge is about to retire. So for all of the negativity about our friend running the United States, there's a chance there could be three. Like that is a generational shift if it happens. But moving on, Dreher, when that happened and the implications of that, he's basically said we've got to look at the Benedict option, which is the kind of, we need to hunker down, we need to draw in, we need to get into safe spaces, we need to be safe as Christians, we need to, certainly around kids and families, etc. And I understand where he's coming from. He's not saying that we should not engage in the world. He's just saying we should keep our families safe. We need to define what we believe. We need to define to our children what we believe. You can't trust church schools anymore about what they're going to say in the broadest sense of the word. Homeschooling, he was pushing. It sounds very negative. It's quite a helpful book. But the problem with the book for me is that I don't think that's the outcome. The outcome is don't retreat. It's not about retreating in fear. There's lots of opportunities out there. So don't be fearful. And all that research is to say, don't just believe the commentariat. Don't just believe the noisy, and I think they're minority within our community. Be careful when you read Twitter. If you heard that joke about Twitter, anybody have Twitter? You know what Twitter is? The joke about Twitter is, Facebook, my party, my life is a party. Instagram, my life is a photo opportunity. YouTube, my life is a movie. Twitter, we're all going to die. And that's kind of funny because it's true. So don't retreat in fear. Be on the front foot. Find places that you can connect in your community and certainly around families. Follow the lead of the early church, CARE. You need to watch our series, even though you can't buy it because it's all gone. One of the things one of the episodes is CARE, and one of the reasons that the early church had such influence across the Greco-Roman world is that it followed a guy that said, "Whatever you do to the least of these, my brethren, you did for me." In a society that didn't care for anybody but themselves and their own family, which was actually callous and uncaring, here are a group of Christians who looked after everybody. Do you know who Tom Holland is? I quoted. Sorry about this. John, this is yesterday's material, John. Do you know who Tom Holland is? What time does this finish, by the way?
No, keep going.
Thank you. Okay, good. I'll just have a bunch of people coming in who are part of the next... Yeah, we don't care. We don't care. Good. Tom Holland has written... You know who he is? He's an author. He's an English. He does BBC documentaries. He's written a book about a couple of novels around the Greco-Roman world. Passionate about the Greco-Roman world. But he's written an article that was released about September 2016. I can't remember which magazine it was in. Just Google it. You'll find it. It's called Why I Changed My Mind About Christianity. And Holland basically said, when I started to look more closely at the Greco-Roman world, I realized it's not just that it was callous. They didn't care for anybody. He said, who were the people who cared? The people who followed Jesus. And he said, when you get to Voltaire and the French Enlightenment, there was already an attitude that we ought to care. They didn't invent it. And he said, even though they tried to reject Christianity because of the connection, certainly in France, between the church and the nobility. But Holland finishes the article, says, even though Western nations around the world are pushing Christianity aside, what I've come to realize that in my morals and in my values, I am not Greek and Roman, but I am thoroughly and proudly Christian. Now, Holland is not saying I'm a Christian. He's not saying I'm born again. He's merely saying, he's recognizing that the value of care actually didn't come from anybody else but the life and teaching of Jesus. That's something we should learn. Rodney Stark, and it's interesting, again, we talked this morning, a quote about the growth of the church across the Greco-Roman world. And we often think about it as explosive, don't we? Went from this tiny little corner of Palestine and then it became, you know, 10 to 20% of the Greco-Roman world. Constantine either became a Christian or believed it was a good idea to get those guys on side. Let's go with became a Christian. But the point was this. Rodney Stark has done crunch the numbers. You know how much they would have grown in his mind? 3% a year. That's all. They didn't have to grow 20% a year. They didn't have to double every year. Just 3% a year, and they went to the size that they influenced the whole Greco-Roman world. One of the reasons that they grew, not only were they doing ministry and missionary work, which happens to be our next series, but that's another whole story, but they cared for people. Is your church known for caring? If you were to say... And I think one of the great weaknesses of the church in the West is that they're more, and ministry organisations, that more and more of them are becoming humanitarian organisations and not gospel orientation organisations. But being a gospel organisation doesn't mean you don't care. If Jesus said you ought to care for the least of these, you ought to care for the broken, the marginalised, the widows, the orphans, where are we in that? And sometimes we can kind of think, oh, well, that's just social justice. That's part of the gospel. And my fear is that often we've tended to use this word missional, which I'm not a fan of for all sorts of reasons. But one of the reasons I'm not a fan of the word missional is because it ends up meaning nothing. It means that everything is the same. We need to refocus on the word evangelism and gospel and telling the message of Jesus, but not by losing care. So one of the ways that you should do is gather your leadership and say, if we were known as a caring church in this area, given the group of people that we have, whether you're 5, 50 or 500, numbers are not important, what gifts and skills have we got? What are the needs in our area? How can we connect those two as a gospel opportunity to redeem our place within the community? That is a great chance. I remember there was a lady in our church when I was working at Guy Mier. She worked for the Sydney City Council, which is a pretty godless organisation. And she was in a meeting, and they often talk about who's kind of asking to do things in their area. And this includes King's Cross, and King's Cross in Sydney is the red light prostitution district and all of that sort of stuff. And so they were talking about, and then they said, look, there's an application from this group. They want to come in and help people. They want to clean up people who are kind of vomiting on the streets. They want to, you know, pick them up. They want to do it. And somebody else said, who would want to do that? And the answer was, the person just said offhandedly, they're the Christians. Isn't that great? They're the Christians. They want to turn up and help the people that nobody else wants to have anything to do with. And care. Be seen as those who care. Act locally. Now, I think what's really important is to connect these two things. Because you know what we're doing at the moment? You know, we've got all this great technology and we're Facebooking our services to the world. You know? We're touching the globe. We're going for the world for Jesus. You know what? The person next door doesn't even know you exist. You know, here's this 56% of people don't know that you exist. You know what we tend to think? We tend to think, okay, they've seen our church, they've seen our sign, they've gone to our website, they've considered being a part of our church, and they've rejected us, and, you know, there you go. That's how they. If you haven't changed anything about your building, they've stopped seeing you for the last 5 years. I mean, you think about the buildings you drive past. I was in Rockhampton speaking last year. Rockhampton is kind of North Queensland, and when I'm speaking to Rockhampton, the guy was chatting to me about the fact that there's this Rockhampton, you know, in downtown, the centre of town, you know, the buildings are 3 or 4 stories. You know, they're sort of like, you know, local... cities around the UK, no high rise. But in the middle, there's I think it's a Presbyterian church, and it's got this massive cross, which is like 20 metres in the air, and it's this gaudy, you know, purple thing, you know, and it's, anyway, this guy's chatting to one of the neighbours, and he lived a block, he said, what do you do? I'm part of this church, and he said, what church? You know, the Presbyterian church. We said, which one's that? And he said, the one with the cross. He said, I haven't seen it. friend of mine went to a church in outer Melbourne, and he was a new Baptist pastor in a church in outer Melbourne. He said to this, he turns up to his new church, and it's quite a reasonable sized church. And he said, how's your connection with the community? And they said, oh, we have great connection with the community. Fantastic. He said, oh, okay. And then he thought, I'll do an experiment. So there was a local shopping area in his area, a strip of shops, and there's 42 shops. And so he just, because he's new in town, and an outer suburb, so he just walked into each shop and asked for where the local Baptist church was. Like, I'm just looking for the local Baptist church, you know what it is? So here's these people saying, yes, we're connected, yes, everybody knows us. 42 shops, local shops. They would, two. And one knew but got it wrong. So, you know, like this whole idea, no, people don't know you're there. You know what I've said, coming out of this, you know what I think the passion for me coming out of this? Draw a 3-kilometre circle around your church and make that your mission field. Make sure everybody in that space knows that you exist. And you know what the tragic thing is? Here we're into Facebooking and we're into doing all this, you know, targeted online. What does your local politician do when he's trying to get elected? They door knock, don't they? Why do they door knock? Because that's the only way you can actually get to people directly. Now, you'd be brave if you go out door knocking, but you can certainly letterbox drop. You can just, there's all sorts of stuff you can do. Here's a radical sign. Here's a radical thought. Put up a new sign. Stick up a banner, like anything. Just change your building. All I'm saying is act locally so that people know you exist. Who's around a 3-kilometre circle? How do we care at a 3-kilometre circle? How do we get influence in that space? Create opportunities for engagement in neutral spaces. On our website, although it's not, it will be available later, just write this down, jesusthegamechanger.com. I do a 10-minute video on how to run a course like Jesus the Game Changer in a neutral venue. So if you were doing Alpha or Jesus the Game Changer or what's that, Christianity Explored, you know, whatever you're running, where do you run it? Normally in people's homes or in your local church. The two places that most people don't want to go to, unless they're your very good friends. Why don't you pick a pub? Why don't you find a room in a pub? You need to find probably a room that you can close the door in, but it's not absolutely necessary. Make sure the video works. Make sure that they can hear it. Let them have a beer or a wine before they come in. If you can have a pub where they can have a meal together at the bistro and then come into the room, even better. And find neutral spaces. Don't always ask people to come to your space. I met you, but I'm, you know, going to places that I don't frequent all the time, like somewhere that's a gambling place or a, you know, a pub or a nightclub. I'm really a fish out of water there. Well, that's what everybody thinks coming to our places. So in some way, look for opportunities for engagement in neutral spaces. And now the trouble is you're thinking, oh, that feels really uncomfortable. Well, yeah, of course it does. But act on that. Find spaces where you've got friends and you say, listen, we've got this new course, whatever the course is, this opportunity. Why don't you come and just watch this DVD with us? We'll have a beer and or a wine or a coffee and a meal beforehand and we just watch it and then we have a bit of a discussion. You want to have it? You want to try it and see how you go. The opportunity for engagement in neutral spaces. Follow the lead of the Celtic monastic movement. Now, again, some of you will be very kind of nervous about that because you'll be thinking, oh, gosh, weren't they Catholics? As I said yesterday, one of the things that really struck me about producing Jesus the Game Changer is that the way I tended to function as a Baptist and a Protestant was that there was a whole bunch of stuff that happened in the first 300 years with Jesus, right? And then nothing happened till 1517. There's 1,200 years there. Something happened. And Europe was won for Jesus in that period of time. It was then lost, but it was won. And one of the things, one of the great stories that we want to tell in our next series is actually the story of St. Patrick. And the intriguing thing about this story of St. Patrick is that here is a guy who was stolen as a teenager, as a slave, from probably Wales to Ireland. And he worked, was held as a slave for 7 years in Ireland. Eventually, it's a long story which we won't go into. But in that time, his parents had some sort of faith, kind of Roman faith, as it were, connected to the Empire of Rome. But out on the hills by himself, looking after sheep, cattle, He deepened his faith in Jesus and he deepened his faith in the Irish people, love for the Irish people. And when he eventually got home to his family, guess what he did? He put a group of people together and went back to Ireland and he won it for Jesus. And there's a serious book out there, serious book written by a guy called Thomas Cahill, even though it's very small, but written by a serious academic. And the reason I make a big deal about that is it's called How the Irish Saved Civilization. Now you're thinking, get out of here. Like, but you know what happened? What was happening in the fourth, fifth century around Rome? It was being sacked by the Goths and the Visigoths, and guess what they were doing when they sacked Rome? They burnt the libraries to the ground. They trashed the place. The place was overrun. And that's when you had the Benedictine monasteries. And what were they doing? You gather for safety. You go to the hills. You get together. Yeah, you work. There's a whole bunch of great stuff they did. But as it were, it was a place of kind of coming away from the world because the world was an unsafe place, which is what you're thinking. What did the Celtic monastic movement do? They set up all of their monasteries on main roads. They welcomed the stranger. They reached out to the people around them. They won Ireland for Jesus. Then they went to Iona. Then they went to Lindisfarne, the Northumberland area. They moved south. Then from there, there was missionary and ministry into Europe. You had quite remarkable gospel ministries from a group of people that we're all a little iffy about from their theological stance. But they won the world for Jesus. But they did it because they were outwardly focused. They were seeking to win the community. So don't retreat in fear. Find a place to be out there. Care for people without losing your gospel focus. Don't just become another humanitarian organization. Act locally. Find neutral spaces. Look outward. What time are we finishing?
5 minutes ago.
5 minutes ago. I would ask for questions, but we're already 5 minutes over. Yes, but you're going to ask a question and everybody's going to look at you going, you're not going to ask a question, are you?
That's ever so helpful. One of the first slides of the no religion sector,
yep.
Was it 23%?
Was yeah, there's 32% no religion, then half of those were, yep.
Statistics, you know, like yep. Churchill said, are wonderful things, you know, there are yep. lies, there are damn lies.
And then there's statistics, yep.
Before I came to Christian when I was 21, I would not have ticked any box nope. for any religion at all. No religious affiliation whatsoever. You know, brought up as a yep. Protestant or liberal. Did I believe in God? Yes, I did.
Yep.
So, you know, the idea that somehow
yep. yeah,
no
absolutely.
Religion means I have no interest in the supernatural. I mean, there are some like that, as it yep. showed, but there are others actually.
You're quoting Rodney Stark. Rodney Stark actually has a page in his book. You're quoting your own experience. Rodney Stark has a page in his book that actually says they've done in America research on no religions. And people who put down nons, they believe in remarkable stuff. Like they believe in the... In fact, they believe in the weirdest group of stuff, you know, like astrology and all sorts of stuff. So absolutely, absolutely. That's a great place to finish. You guys have been gracious and wonderful, and it's been good to be with you, so thank you.
Thank you.
Bless you. Thank you. Thank you.